Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Welcome to Borderlines from the Irish Times with me, Mary Minahan.
And me, Freya McClements.
This podcast is about changing identities north and south, with one presenter on either side of the border, chatting to a guest who has spent time reflecting on the complex issues involved.
And our guest today is the playwright and author Rosemary Jenkinson, who lives in and writes about East Belfast, as well as many, many other things I'm sure she would clarify. Her latest collection of short stories, Marching Season, is out now.
You're very welcome, Rosemary.
Thanks very much, Mary. Delighted to be here.
Rosemary, I mean, certainly to people in the North and Northern Ireland, you know, marching season, everybody knows exactly what this is. But there's something I just have to ask you about this. You were writing in the Irish Times a couple of months ago about marching season. And I think it's the last thing anybody would expect to associate with that. You said writing a story is like having sex with a stranger in the dark. I think you're going to have to explain that for us.
Yeah, some people totally disagreed with that. What are you talking about? But look, when you write a short story, you're trying to give your reader a thrill within a short time. So that's like sex for a start. And also, I said it was like being with a stranger in the dark, which is like feeling your way instinctively through the story. And you're not sure quite, you have an idea where you're going to end up, but you don't know what's going to really happen on the way. So that's, it is. I believe it is. Totally like sex with a stranger in the dark.
I would know, would you, Freya?
I was sort of trying to puzzle this out before we, before asking. I can't possibly think what you might mean, you know, but
now you've explained. Yes, you need to have a few experiences to draw from to understand that analogy, Freya.
Well, you start to get into sort of, you know, are you talking about, you know, so it's writing a new short story is a step into the unknown, but, you know, you do have some experience because you've done this before, you know, you've written several collections of short stories. So it's that combination of, you know, you've been here before, you've done this before, you have an idea of how it works, but you're still, it is still stepping into the dark, it's stepping into the unknown, because each time presumably must be slightly different, but you're relying on those previous experiences to guide you.
Completely. I mean, I suppose when I thought about, say, The Stranger in the Dark, I was thinking about the reader and what I can, you know, you're always trying to, certainly I do, I try to charm them, shock them, give them every sort of experience that they can possibly have, really. So, yeah, I think about the reader a lot, and you never know what quite. So, I mean, I always have an ending in mind, but you don't quite know how you're going to get there.
That's the exciting bit.
Yes, it is.
Rosemary, can I ask you, when did you first feel confident enough to start calling yourself a writer? Was it something you always wanted from childhood?
I certainly grew up in a house with a lot of books, and it was a bookish childhood. My mother was an art teacher, so I was very much used to her practicing her art. I always wanted to be a writer, but calling yourself a writer is a totally different thing. When is that justified that you can call yourself? And I mean, certainly I didn't call myself a writer when I'd even had my first few short stories published. I think really I needed a proper play, I needed a book. So I don't use the term lightly. I think, you know, a lot of people think they can just put a few stories out there and hey presto, you're a writer. But it's part of the vocation, it's a lifestyle choice. It's a big decision and you need to earn it, I think, to be a writer.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think you certainly earned it, because just from my own knowledge of you and sort of coming across you over the years at sort of different, you know, writing events or whatever, I mean, you're incredibly prolific. You know, if it's not another short story collection, it's another play, you know, and so much of this deals with identity as well, and these really kind of complex identities in Northern Ireland, and you're regarded as a Protestant writer. And I wanted to ask you about your own childhood and your sense of your identity as you were growing up. You know, did you have a very sort of fixed sense of identity, or was it something that emerged more through your writing?
Yeah, well, it's changed obviously a lot from when I grew up. I mean, I always say my very first image of Northern Ireland was, I saw it visually that Ireland was to the south of us, England was to the north of us, and we were in the middle of hybrid no man's land, neither one nor the other. And that was my very original thought of what being Northern Irish is, nothing really, both, nothing in both. So it's a kind of paradox, really, what we are. And yeah, so, well, that kind of upbringing was very much, I was during the Troubles. And even though I lived in a very middle class area, and it wasn't that much troubled by the Troubles, because we did have a bomb scare in our street when I was 7 years old. I wasn't allowed into my street. And I remember I was really scared and trying to find my mother. And it kind of, we sat while the army defused the bomb. I remember sitting in neighbouring streets, and people brought out cups of tea and sweets for us. And I realised how fragile life was, and that even though we thought we were in our little cocoon from the Troubles, it was ever so much bigger and it could impinge on you at any time. So that was a real sort of learning curve early on. And my identity was very British, I think, then, because, you know, you felt it. It was very much them and us, and it was IRA bombs, and, you know, so it was very polarized then. So, and that pushes you into extremes of identity, which obviously since the peace process hasn't been the case.
I wonder how that's changed in terms of how you regard yourself now, because a little bit earlier you described yourself as Northern Irish, and then you said about, you know, well, your upbringing was very British. You know, are you Northern Irish? Are you British? Are you Irish?
Yes. I think that sounds like the Holy Trinity, British, Irish and Northern Irish. We'll take them all. Yeah, I'll take whatever actually suits me at the time and is advantageous as well as a writer. I mean, we have to accept multiple identities in this world. And yeah, there's a certain amount of self-interest, but it's also a certain amount of what I culturally feel. I feel a relation to everything a lot more now. I mean, certainly I would feel more Irish, I suppose, when I came back in 2002, after I went to university in 86, and I only had one visit to Northern Ireland back since, from 86 to 2002, which is nothing. So really, I was completely divorced from this country. And I think, yeah, I kind of got to know more. I was going to Irish language events. I was going to traditional session events. And I did then realise that there is an Irish aspect to the culture here that I can't ignore, and that is right cheek by jowl to what I grew up with. And so therefore, I do feel more Irish through culture.
So Rosemary, were you part of that classic brain drain that happens in Northern Ireland, where young people go away to university and very often don't come back for a variety of reasons? And how useful was your time away in informing the work that you do now, and I suppose just getting perspective on Northern Ireland?
Yeah, I was part of the brain drain. In fact, I was even part of a BBC programme in 1986 on the brain drain. So it was the big term at that time as well. So nothing's changed really, except, of course, a lot more of us went during the Troubles. And I always said our teachers told us to. They said, what are you doing here? And I always said they did a better job of ethnically cleansing Protestants than the IRA ever did, because they basically persuaded us to go. So that was it. So I did go, and I kind of realised in England that it was a much more boring country. You know, the excitement, I think Northern Ireland is a much more interesting And even though England has sort of, it's culturally diverse with so many immigrants, it isn't quite as fascinating because the cultures aren't so interwoven as the British and Irish culture is in Northern Ireland. So when I went to England, I did try to write. I started trying to write. I had lots of different jobs and I also tried to write on the side. And it didn't really connect. I didn't feel any place that I could connect there. I mean, my parents lived in a small town. They moved. That was another thing. The weird thing was, as soon as I left university, I had no home to come back to in Northern Ireland because my parents left to live in Berwick-upon-Tweed, a tiny town on the border with Scotland. And I didn't feel connected to Berwick-upon-Tweed or anything. So nowhere really. I went to university at Durham, so no connection there. So it really, the nostalgia hit me and I thought that I really had to come home, and that was obviously the right place. I suppose instinctively my inner writer was telling me, go home. So I did. Even though there was no home, I made my own home.
I think you're the first person I've ever spoken to who's sort of compared Northern Ireland and England as, you know, England's more boring and Northern Ireland is more interesting. But I kind of know what you mean. And one of the things about your work is that I think you look at life, actually, not just your writing, in a sort of a slightly different way. And a lot of what you write is also really, really funny. And I'm thinking of some of the things like your Michelle and Arlene series of plays. So these are sort of based around the premise that Michelle O'Neill, the Deputy First Minister of Sinn Féin, and Arlene Foster, who was then the Northern Ireland First Minister from the DUP, and they sort of become big friends after this kind of mad girls weekend, you know. And there's a real sort of northern thing about that in terms of that way of using comedy or satire to make serious points, but also to talk about things that would be much harder to talk about otherwise, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, satire is particularly a Northern Irish strength because our politics are satirical without even trying to portray them as such. So definitely. I mean, I pushed it to the extreme. They were lovers in this play, and you know, and why not? Why not? I mean, it's that whole thing about the two enemies are so full of hatred. They love each other, and that's really a kind of metaphor for Northern Irish politics. Sort of, there's some sort of love there because we're so intertwined and interrelated and in every way. So, but humour also, it's the only way to approach Northern Ireland with black humour, because it's the way we coped in the Troubles and we still cope with modern absurdities as Brexit and everything.
Can I ask you, Rosemary, you talked about when you first went to England and then you maybe surprised yourself a little by going to Irish language events and traditional music events, and maybe it brought you to a different place in terms of your identity. Do you think that would have happened if you hadn't have gone to England? I know it's, I think, a common enough experience for people from a Protestant unionist background in Northern Ireland who go to England and the immediate assumption is they're Irish, they're nationalist. Like, was that a shock to you at first?
I mean, I felt that being Northern Irish and a Protestant was not cool. And yeah, there was a lot of people, at that time who said, get out of their country. What are you doing there? So, you know, again, that was during Troubles time and that was much more polarized. The one is interesting about coming back, and how do you feel, or does that make it easier? It did make it easier because I didn't have any friends from my past. I had no school friends. I hadn't kept in touch. All of us had just been away for so many years. And actually, most of my school friends also left. So we were scattered, really. So we could say a huge diaspora, but except we weren't united in it at all, which is very typical of Protestants. We all just go our own way and don't club together. We're not very clubbable. And that's our sort of dissident individual tradition. So when I came back, I met a lot of much more people from a Republican background, because they were the ones that I met just in the pubs. As I said, I was going out to see musics and I would meet them in the pubs. And if I hadn't have come back, I would never have had more Republican friends than Unionist or Loyalist friends or even neutral friends. So that definitely, they brought me into their world. I mean, it's a very different thing watching from the outside, but for being brought in and explained the culture and the history was so much better for me. And so that's what happened.
When you were in England and people were saying to you, get out of their country, what are you doing there? These were English people saying that to you. Is that right?
Yeah, English people. Many English people at my university had been on trips to the falls. I realised of sort of this is to show them the conflict if they were politically interested. So you'd definitely get people who had already predetermined ideas in England. There was a lot of interest in the conflict at that time. So yeah, it was tough because you don't want to be, I wanted to be part of England, or, well, to meld a lot more, and yet you're kind of immediately, associated with negativity as if you have caused the whole problem from day one, which is ridiculous, but people still believe that.
I sort of have a theory that everybody from Northern Ireland needs to go away for a period of time and then should come back because it gives you a different perspective. And both myself and Mary went away to university as well and then chose to come back. And, you know, I mean, I really think, you know, if the executive, you know, could put up the money for every 18-year-old sort of to go somewhere for a year, you know, I think it would make a huge difference. And particularly when you grow up during the Troubles and when you suddenly go away, you realise actually it's not like that wasn't normal. And Mary's written sort of really well about this as well, in terms of, you know, sort of seeing like English bobbies walking down the street and realizing, you know, that not all policemen had, you know, heavy weaponry and you know, bulletproof vests and stuff. And I just wonder what you think about, you know, you do have a different perspective when you've been away and you come home, don't you?
Definitely. And of course, I was called, yeah, somebody shouted out Paddy at me in the street. And I'm not even, they had to shout it about 100 times. I'm like, that can't be. It's not possible. You know, a Northern Irish Protestant, this doesn't happen. And yeah, all of those experiences. Yeah. And yeah, in my interview, the lecture saying, you know, you're very medieval in Northern Ireland. I mean, I was studying medieval literature, but it was like, yeah, your conflict is medieval. And it was like, yeah. And now we see, you know, it's so strange. Like now you have that terrorism, obviously, from Islamic fundamentalists, you know, and it's strange to sort of see that we were kind of considered like that in those days, you know, the we were all fundamentalists, which we weren't. So yeah, it's a very strange, but I totally agree with you about going away. And in fact, I did have an experience. This was in my early 30s. I went to Palestine, and that also gave me another perspective on a conflict that wasn't Northern Ireland, and also kind of made me understand how maybe it would have been perceived from a Republican side in West Belfast, all the kind of militarised. I mean, I grew up obviously with the same, not the same militarisation, but I saw police and army people everywhere, but it wasn't a threat, you know, whereas I can understand that it was a threat to some, but for me, it wasn't. It was just sort of a protector rather than a threat. So it's those completely differing mindsets that you only get from being really away.
It's interesting because it's all about perspective, isn't it, Rosemary?
Yeah.
And did you come up against that thing? This is changing now a lot, but I think probably when you were starting out, there was that sense that nationalists and Republicans were more dominant in the arts. Now, there were various reasons for that, but not only that, but they had better control of their own, if you like, political and historical narrative. Was that something you experienced and perhaps found a bit frustrating?
It is difficult because, yeah, that's the dominant narrative throughout Ireland. So it obviously has a huge, the nationalist perspective is a lot stronger and a lot, just many more followers. You know, it's a minority thing. So And I think there's that negative colonial aspect to being from that Protestant background. And I mean, it's almost like it's very difficult to use history because it is awkward. I mean, I was even thinking, like, my ancestors, the original Jenkinsons, would have come over via, it was thought, my uncle did research and he thought it was through the Cromwellian army and that he was given land instead of money. So, and that is an incredible, awful thing to think of because that makes me hated immediately within Ireland. It's like, so these are really awkward and horrible sort of things. But I mean, it was a historical fact and, you know, he came from Northern England and for whatever reasons, wanting to make a better life and to be paid as a soldier, you know, but these are very awkward things, I feel. And that's probably not as awkward. No nationalist, I don't think, has something as awkward as that. Well, many nationalists do through the whole intermarriage. They will have these awkward things, but they will conveniently forget about them, probably. But I just feel that you always feel that you're not liked, really, as a Protestant Northern Irish person, that you're the fly in the ointment, the one thing stopping the unity. And it just feels sometimes when you write, I mean, I write mainly about modern things rather than history because I'd much rather confront them than the old sores of the past. So that's one way, really, of getting around awkward historical things. And but I mean, I think there has been a huge rise in and confidence in Protestant writing, because we realise that, you know, people do want to hear these stories. They are interesting. It's a matter of perspective and everybody should hear different perspectives. So, you know, I'm very glad that there is increasing interest in it. But having said that, I also don't want to be pigeonholed. That's the whole aspect.
It's interesting when you sort of talk about all of this and your own family sort of ancestry. I mean, that's going sort of back to the 17th century. So your family have been here for a long, long time. And I can't imagine that anybody would say, well, you know, you've as much right to be here as anybody else would and to be part of that conversation. But I'm thinking of, you know, a lot of the dialogue that's going on at the minute around the United Islands or border poles or shared islands and all of this. And there is a narrative that sort of almost that, well, unionists just have to, you know, they have to be, this is happening anyway, so they have to be part of this and they have to just sort of talk about this and accept that. And, you know, the criticism that people from a unionist background will sometimes make is that, well, it's not a conversation if the end is predetermined. You know, is there a way of having these conversations and of making them inclusive and of coming to some sort of solution that works for everybody?
Well, I don't think there's a problem in talking about the possibility of a border poll because the end game is not decided. The vote will decide that, which has nothing to do really with the discussions beforehand. So I have no problem about talking about that. And I think that unionists should definitely talk about it. I don't think anything should be off the table and vetoed. You know, we have freedom of speech. Everybody should be talking about this. And I think for me as a writer, I mean, a border poll would be wonderful because I would have loads of writing material to write about. You know, upheaval is great. I've always said that for writers. So we welcome change and, yeah, all of those difficult conversations. So, yeah, I think definitely there needs to be more discussion on the border and what to do about it.
Can I ask you, Rosemary, when you were growing up, what was your impression of the Republic? And I suppose, what is it now and how has it changed over the years?
When I was a child, we went to Achill Island a couple of summers because my aunt was Southern Irish and we would go there. We'd go amethyst hunting and it was wonderful. I loved it. Yeah, I had good experiences of Southern Ireland, very good ones. There was that whole thing that people from the north thought that it was a bit of a primitive country in terms of infrastructure. So there was that kind of bias there, definitely, and maybe a slightly lofty feeling that we were ever so much wealthier up in Northern Ireland and things. So there was that perspective.
You're listening to Borderlines. We'll continue our conversation with Rosemary Jenkinson after this short break.
On Formative, middle school kids from New York City public schools interview a phenomenal collection of grown-ups.
Me, like, I don't know what I want to do.
You don't have to have all the answers.
I feel like a lot of people's favorite topics are, like, interest in their life.
That is a really good answer.
The podcast where the leaders of today are interviewed by leaders of tomorrow. Listen now at newyorkedge.org/formative or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Welcome back to Borderlines. Today we're talking to Rosemary Jenkinson about culture, identity, and her belief that fiction writers shouldn't focus on the Troubles too much.
We've sort of talked a lot about identity and things like that, but not quite so much about your own work in regard to this. And I'm just thinking of, you know, some of the things we've been talking about, you know, the sort of things you write about, and you write a lot about the Troubles, but also the outworkings of the Troubles and sort of the contemporary issues and where we are now. And you were writing in the Irish Times recently. You wrote, "I don't want to be pigeonholed as a Troubles writer, a post-conflict writer, or a Protestant writer just because I'm from Northern Ireland. I choose to be a universal writer, neither confined by the country I come from, the body I was born into, nor the era I've lived through." You know, how much choice does a writer really have in these things? You know, these are the big things that have happened in your lifetime, and you write about them.
Yeah, I mean, I don't write about the Troubles. I've never written directly about the Troubles. Everything is through the prism of the present, looking back at the Troubles. So I'm not interested in the Troubles. Maybe in memoir form, but certainly not in fictional form or play form, because I think, I think it's largely over, but it isn't. It's still rumble. I'm interested in the present rumblings that could potentially unleash another Troubles scenario. And I suppose a border poll, we always think that, you know, there could be some sort of Troubles scenario depending on the vote. So I suppose I'm interested in that way. But I suppose, yeah, it's a difficult one to say. Yeah, I'm not sure.
Maybe it just depends on your interpretation, because I suppose a lot of people will say that the Troubles is still inherent in absolutely everything here, but it's the, you're more interested in the contemporary outworkings of this.
Yeah, but I mean, I do think I have said in the piece I wrote for Fortnight that I do believe that it is, there's too much about the Troubles right now, and it is a very easy default position for writers to slide into, and even though I totally get that there's trauma that still has to be worked through, and I wouldn't deny anyone the right to work that through, but I do feel that since Anna Burns also came out with her huge Troubles novel, I do think there could be a slight copycat reverberation through that, and writers need to do their own thing, and they should also accept that I don't think there should be so much Troubles plays or fiction. I think that they should accept that, or question, actually, what is the need for all this Troubles work? I mean, how can you make it so different from what has gone before? I think that's my very question about Troubles work.
I suppose just for context, you wrote the piece in Fortnight, which you mentioned, and Fortnight is a long-running magazine based in Belfast with, an honourable tradition of amplifying the intersection between politics and culture and the arts. Your piece, Rosemary, had the headline, "The Troubles with Northern Irish Literature." It was a long piece, but you mentioned, among other things, what you call the retrogressive gaze and the idea of writers feasting on the corpse of the Troubles. We should tease out the many ideas you had in the piece, but I suppose I first of all wanted to ask, had you any regrets about writing that piece, given the fairly explosive impact it had in the North and Northern Ireland?
I hit it hard, the subject very hard, so I don't regret it because I think what I was saying was perfectly valid. But I mean, certainly I was surprised by the outpouring and I realised that I had a sensitive nerve. So while I was saying no regrets, I didn't mean to stir such a hornet's nest. Certainly not. I sort of caught me by surprise, the strength of feeling. And but I do think that writers of all should be the ones who accept criticism and look to why there might be criticism and really be very open. It surprises me if writers are very angry and sensitive and closed on certain subjects. We should be the most liberal and open of all.
Where did the reaction come most strongly, Rosemary? Was it Twitter or where did you get this big reaction?
Oh, yeah. Twitter, obviously you had an article in the Irish Times against us, well, but Twitter,
which you then
obviously
responded to as well.
Which I responded to. Well, you have to. You can't completely left. I talked to my publisher about it, Alan Hayes, and we kind of said that it would be good to reply rather than just let it go, because you can let these things go and just it's fine. But I was happy to respond. And obviously, I mean, Twitter is obviously the most nasty sort of area for people to vent, and they're not really their themselves, their rational selves. It's more of that kind of gut instinct, and it's a pack animal thing on Twitter, which is the unfortunate thing about it. So it was a good, let's say it was a good reaction, and it's good to have that debate. I mean, I was glad that there was a response to in the Irish Times and that we had this debate, because it needs to be talked about, like, why is the Troubles right now? Why is there so much of it? I said about Kenneth Branagh's Belfast coming up. What is it right now? That is it a distraction from the current politics, the Brexit, the protocol? What is, you know, there's a lot of questions for this. Why are we looking at the past? Is it because it's inconvenient to look at the present, or much more convenient to turn away from the present? I don't know, but, you know, these are questions that writers should be having in Northern Ireland.
Do you not think maybe it's a generational thing, Rosemary? Like some of the writers you mentioned, I suppose Kerry-Ne Doherty's Thin Places and Seamus O'Reilly's Did You Hear Mommy Died, Alex O'Neill, The Troubles With Us, they're all younger writers and they're kind of coming of age now. Is it not that maybe that they're finding a voice in the way that an older generation had a whatever you say nothing kind of attitude that was drummed into them, beaten into them over the years?
Yeah, in memoir, I can completely understand that more than through fiction. I can understand it through that. And it's a kind of outworking of the past and how it also affects the present. I mean, that's what I do, and I appreciate people who do that. But I would think that it's just so much fictional. And I do think whatever you say, nothing hasn't been really operating since the Good Friday Agreement. I think during the peace process, we've had plenty of plays about the Troubles, certainly on stage, plenty through Owen McCafferty, Silent, and you know, so there has been a lot over the years. I'm just saying that right now, I think it's English publishers, British publishers, jumping on that and kind of really, because I was saying about when I wrote in the article, I wrote about it's the journalists coming out with top 10 Troubles novels. You know, it's like we're in a genre. And this was the whole thing I was saying. We cannot be pigeonholed and pushed into writing about the Troubles through outside journalism and publishing. So I do, yeah, that's what I am objecting to, really, that push from outside.
Have you ever felt any pressure to write work that fulfills these external expectations as you see them?
Well, I would tend to resist any external and plough my own path in that sense. I suppose, oh, there's definitely, and I do think in playwriting, and there has always been this, that you're expected to write the great sort of definitive play about what Northern Ireland is like for Protestants. Certainly I would be. I think you're very much put in your hole and expected to do the Protestant perspective. This is Rosemary. She will write the Protestant perspective for us. But actually, as in Michelle Narlene, as you pointed out, Freya, I like doing both as well. And people don't like that so much. They like to put you, make sure you're in your own category.
And how do you feel, Rosemary, when, you know, certain writers are grouped together because of their cultural heritage, maybe Jan Carson, Wendy Erskine, yourself, you know, do you like that? Is it beneficial for you? Does it feel false? Like, is there a sense of camaraderie?
Well, we certainly have things in common to say, but I mean, all writers are individual. And I mean, I see them a lot. So there is that camaraderie at events. But I mean, we're completely individual and we're not comparing notes in any way. Mm. I certainly don't want to write the same things or be influenced. That's what, one of the things I also said in the Fortnite article, that I don't want us all to be doing the same thing and reading each other too much. And that can be a real negative. I don't want to be part of a movement. That's certainly something I would be very resistant against, because I think writers should be completely unique. So I don't think it's helpful, but I do think that maybe it gets us some group publicity, which is also, you can say, sure, is a good thing. So, you know, there are swings and roundabouts, but essentially I don't want to be part of a Protestant female writing group. We sound like the Derry Girls, like a girl band or something.
These Belfast Girls or something.
These Belfast Girls. That's us. Yeah, that's us. We actually will start doing that. That's our next event. Thanks, Freya, for that.
Not at all. You're very welcome. I mean, just on that, you know, you've recently talked about the East, by which we obviously mean East Belfast, is the current creative hotbed of Belfast. And there is a sense that it's an area that's kind of, you know, really up and coming in that sense. And I think it's fair to say that you're one of the writers and the creatives at the heart of that. I mean, tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, I suppose there's been quite a lot of regeneration in that area. And there's also a lot, actually, it's also been very much more integrated. You know, there's social, very much mixed social housing here. So it's not its own Protestant heartland, that even though it still keeps that overall identity, but it is a much, much more diverse community. More ethnic minorities coming in. So it is an interesting area. And I think there's a lot of artist studios. So it's more of a kind of hip place. But I mean, what I'm probably most interested in is the kind of loyalist areas I write about. I live in one, and, you know, I would find that very interesting in terms of the grittiness as well. It gives you urban grit in your writing. So there's still that, but there is more kind of literary magazines, like, well, it's actually a music magazine, but it takes literature, like Dig With It has come out. There's a bit more of a cultural outpouring in East Belfast, which is a good thing. And of course, the C.S. Lewis Centre also is an arts hub. So it is a happening place culturally.
So get down to East Belfast. There's one last thing that I want to ask you about. You talked about, you know, black humour and, you know, all the funny material that's all around you, and how upheaval it is great. You know, what would be your, you know, what's the thing you're dying to write about now? You know, what's the thing that you've seen on the news or you've heard's happening and you're thinking, this is just perfect? You know, this has just been handed to me on a plate.
I can't, Freya, never ask a writer that. You know, there are hundreds of writers sitting out there going, what's my next idea? And then they wouldn't even realise that if I'd said something and they would suddenly be influenced, and there I'd lose my perspective. My killer idea, that high concept that we all search for. So, so there never really is like that. It doesn't usually come out like that, that you just have one killer idea. You've got a few killer ideas circulating from one time. Yeah, so I have a few ideas, yeah, on the boil.
Watch this space.
You never know. It could be about sex with a stranger. We could go back to that again.
What is it?
Full circle.
Sex with a stranger in a dark. Don't forget the darkness.
Oh, you couldn't forget that. No, no, it's a vital component.
That was Rosemary Jenkinson ending our discussion on a positive and somewhat spicy note. Next week, we're talking to the author of Did You Hear Mommy Died, Seamus O'Reilly, about the porous border between Derry and Donegal and the type of black humour that is particular to Northern Ireland.
That's on Borderlines every Monday from me, Freya McClements.
And me, Mary Minahan, and our producer, Declan Conlon. Thank you for listening and goodbye for now.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.